Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
But anyways, something we talked about at an in-service that you did recently, something that I've been seeing, and it's just kind of been present in my mind, is, and since we had the Olympics just happen, this misconception that athletes are somehow supposed to be the best movers.
Yeah,
they can move really well. They probably have great flexibility. They probably do great at yoga or Pilates. It's,
No, not really.
Yeah. Because they like to, you know, you see some type of press or some video of LeBron is working out, or Usain Bolt is working out, and you're watching them do these horrible looking squats and just cleans and presses that just look very poorly done, even to laymen. So I guess I want to kind of talk, put that, this reconsider that elite athletes have to be good movers, or or reconsider the fact that athletes are the best compensators, and understanding that.
Yeah. Well, so there's, especially at the Olympics, let's recognize the fact that everything is driven hard towards specificity. Like, the exceptions to that rule would be the decathlon and heptathlon or something like that. But even those guys have biases that make them so much better at certain events than others. But let's just pick a couple of sports. And the one that always stands out for me is swimming, because you can see everything, you know, like as they're standing on the blocks, and every, like, if they, like, they get different colored caps on so they can see what country they're from. And it's like if they didn't have that, you would have no idea who you're looking at, because they got the goggles and the cap on, and all the physiques look kind of the same.
Yeah.
Like, the physical structure is the same. And that is selected for swimming, because that body type works the best. It cuts through the water. It floats on top of the water. They are anteriorly oriented to the gills. They have small pelvises. They have big feet, long limbs, big hands, right? So they are perfectly designed to be water-based animals.
Except without the gills.
Well, you never know. So what becomes very, very important here, and when you think about the excursions that the shoulders have to make, the ER orientation of sockets, it gives them tremendous advantages. If you've ever tried to swim butterfly, ever, it is virtually impossible without the capacity to ER orient, because of the extreme representation. Now, the drawback here is that the amount of that they can produce on land is poor. And so this is why you see their feet on the ground, and they have all the, like, people, they'll get accused of having flat feet or low arches or flat arches or whatever. What this is they, so as they're standing, their entire body is sort of locked into one piece and shoved forward. So they look like a big C shape with 2 feet on the ground. And then this pushes the midfoot and the forefoot into the ground rather aggressively. The ER through the hips pushes the pelvis forward. The latissimus dorsi, very compressed against the rib cage, pushing that forward, turns all of the sockets away from midline, gives them this tremendous advantage for external rotation that they need to swim. But again, it's like, that's like, it's a lot of guys that were great swimmers. Not just like, oh, I swam in high school kind of a thing. Like, I'm talking about guys that were really, really high level swimmers. It's very difficult for them to transition into other activities. So for instance, if you were a runner or a cyclist and you wanted to become a triathlete, you just got to be able to swim enough, right? If you're a great swimmer, you're not a great runner.
So, yeah, I could be great on a bike either.
Probably not.
Yeah.
It's like that transition is much more difficult, just because of the specificity of being like a great high level swimmer. There may be a few people that can do it, you know, fairly well, but they would tend to not be like the upper echelon of triathlon because of the specificity. Probably the biggest misconception is about gymnasts, I think, as far as
right.
what their ability to move is. tremendous ability to move into ER, away from midline. Lots of bony adaptation. So you see it probably more pronounced in the female gymnast, I think, than you would in the male, but the males are very similar in that regard. But I think it's easier to see just in the females just because of the way that they move. You see tremendous amounts of IR in the spine. So it's not unusual to find a pars defect in a lumbar spine of a high level gymnast, and it may or may not be painful. I've seen enough of them in the younger females, especially that and it ends their career. They tend to gravitate towards something.
Pars is like a bony adaptation in the spine, right?
It's a fracture. It's literally a fracture. It's a fracture in the spine. So the pars articularis fracture. It's a Scotty dog. Like when you look at the X-ray, it looks like a terrier with a collar on. You can see.
Okay, and that you're saying that some of the gymnasts that have pars fractures don't even know they have pars fractures.
Correct, because it happens progressively. It happens early. And then it just enhances their ability to bend. And if it's not painful, it's like, why would you even know? So, but again, it's kind of like baseball players that have labrum tears that enhances their ability to throw. It becomes sort of like a constraint change that contributes to performance. Regardless, they have a lot more mobility in those bones that allows them to acquire this. But if you look at still frames of gymnasts in certain positions, like if they're doing like a jump split or something like that, it's like people think that this is some sort of like a front to back kind of a movement, when the reality is it's a twist in the spine, it's a bend in the spine, it's a compression of the pelvis, it turns the hip sockets away from midline. They have an exaggerated bend in their femur that also exaggerates the external rotation and allows them to acquire these extreme positions. And so like most people would think that, oh, it's a muscle length thing. It's like, you got to really understand the numerous things that contribute to these positions. In every case that you would see, you know, the extreme ranges of motion, it's like they have many adaptations that allow this to happen.
Yeah. I think that's a good point to kind of circle back to, is the misconception comes from people, I think, believing that these athletes' pelvis and rib cage is in some sort of middle position, and then they're getting these large excursions from that starting point. It's like, no, very much so away from midline, smashed from front to back, tilted and pointed at the ground. And then I take that whole thing and I turn it. I allow the spine to turn that pelvis in one piece, so that when you see that front to back jump split, the pelvis is actually rotated completely to the side, and the spine is giving way to allow that to happen. The example that you have given in the past has been about like ballerinas and gymnasts who they can, while laying on a table, can put their legs, their knee to their face. But that's not, again, is not because of some sort of muscle length or like extraordinary flexibility from a middle position of a pelvis. It's from that, the ability to orient your lumbar spine and then also orient your cervical spine. So you're doing this like bottom up orientation, like all the way up the spine, that allows that leg to get, I guess, maybe explain that or expound on that a little bit, like that's how that spinal orientation helps.
Yeah. So basically what you need is to create spaces to move into. Versus having like some sort of weird extreme muscle length, because if you had muscles that were actually that long, the amount of force that they could produce would be minimal, like in that circumstance.
Right.
And so that's why that doesn't happen. But if you have like a skeletal shape and then the ability to adapt a bone that allows it to twist. So again, to bring the leg into a space that's in front of your face, there's a tremendous amount of spinal turn. So if I can turn a spine, so normally the, you know, the spine would face forward. If I can turn that spine to the extreme where, like, just say like a 90 degree turn, so where the spine would be facing forward and now it faces directly to the right, that creates a gigantic space for you to move a limb into. And that's kind of how they do that. And they do this like progressively in segments. You can even see them make like an upper neck and a jaw adjustment in certain positions to create enough turning through the, like, the upper cervical spine and even into the jaw and the cranium to move the leg up into those spaces. And so it's just a matter of recognition of how they do that.
Right.
And again, not necessarily the healthiest thing. So, you know, you see the gymnasts in their 40s. There's a lot of total joints that take place. There's a lot of surgeries that take place. There's a lot of back pain. You even read stories about some of the more recent popular gymnasts where they talk about like how often they are performing in pain because of the extremes that they're exposed to.
Yeah, I mean, you can see a lot of them wearing kinesio tape. A lot of them have taped ankles, taped joints, like fingers and toes. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, just because they've exceeded, they're outside the realm of relative motions. And I think that's one of the things is most of these athletes are playing. A lot of times, they're playing and producing force outside of their like helical axes.
Right.
So that the paths of which are paths of least resistance for them to move through space don't really, they're not set up structurally in order to move along those pathways. Like, everything is oriented in order to produce forces quickly and in high intensities that are very specific to the sport that they're performing.
Yeah. Well, if you think about, okay, so if you think about the explosiveness that is required, and so let's look at gymnasts, and granted, they've got a spring-loaded floor that they do the floor routine on, which exaggerates their ability to do certain things, but they have to be able to lock segments together to a great degree to create these high forces that allow them to leave the ground, you know, with such force, and then when you think about an energy transfer to do such things, that's got to be connected tissue behavior, which means you cannot have a lot of relative joint movement. Relative joint movement, which would be like segments that can actually move in opposition versus moving together. So when you have relative motion like that, it actually dampens your ability to produce force, which is why we see a lot of the things that we see in any high level, high force athlete. Because again, it's like there's a price to be paid for it. There's a lot of wear and tear on structure that would be associated with the amount of force that has to, or amount of energy rather, that has to be translated through the different segments of the body.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, they behave a lot like a big giant slingshot where you pull the rubber band back and you snap it forward, and that's a lot of energy and it does amazing cool things. But again, there are secondary consequences to be paid.
Well, yeah, when I pull on that elastic connective tissue and it's attached to something that moves with relative motion, I don't get a tremendous return. But if I lock and jam that one space into orientation, mm-hmm. I get a much harder position to pull from. It's that whole you can't fire a cannon from a canoe type of thing.
Yeah.
It's like shooting a cannon from a canoe.
Yeah.
And it's the people I've been around you enough that people ask you this question all the time is, have you ever seen someone with a normal infrasternal angle behavior? Do you ever see someone with normal middle of the road measurements? It's no, because those people have the relative motions. They don't ever need to go to see a PT. They don't really need to go to the doctor too often. They just kind of live until they're in their 80s and then don't really have a lot of pain and they're good. Nothing extraordinary ever happened to them.
Right. So what we get to see is like these biases of structure is what allows people to do amazing things. So, you know, when I don't know if you're, you know what I'm talking about. I don't know if anybody else is going to recognize this other than the people.
I'll try to translate.
Well, okay, Soviet sports schools, Chinese sports schools, et cetera.
Sure.
Right. So what they do is they take this these huge populations of kids and they put them through the ringer of like just exposure to as many different activities as they can over a series of years. And what they're doing is they're selecting out people that end up having these structures, and then they put them on these paths to whatever, whatever. It's like, you're going to be a gymnast. You're going to be a sprinter. You're going to be a basketball player. Right. And
yeah,
we don't do that because our population is huge and diverse in its genetics. And so this allows people to just sort of like float to the cream of the crop. It's like, that's why you have like, you know, like you look at all the different leagues of basketball that kids are exposed to. You look at all of the showcases that people think that they need to go to get baseball exposures and things like that. And you start to see these, like these people just sort of creep up. It's like, look, this kid is now amazing. He can now throw, you know, 98 miles an hour. And it's like, okay, so we'll just select him out. Whereas they would do this by intention, where they're, again, they expose these kids to a whole bunch of different things and they say, oh, you're going to be really, really good at this. And so, you know, that everybody is going to be selected to something, but if you're incredibly average, you're not good at anything. And so nobody ever hears about you. You're an average dude. You work an average job. You marry an average woman. You have two average kids and you live probably a reasonably average, happy life, you know?
Yeah.
But you're not special. Well, your mom thinks you're special because
sure.
You know, that's what she says. But as far as the world is concerned, it's like you don't have any superpowers. All of these structural biases create superpowers that allow people to do amazing things to whatever degree. Right.
Yeah. And but a lot of times, like you were mentioning, they have some sort of negative secondary consequence in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Oh, there's always a price to pay. Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 If you're going to be great, like great, great, great at something, you're giving up something or you never had it to begin with.
Right.
And it, that could be the thing that is the measure of health that you need to do, you know, like the normal everyday things like breathe, pump blood, you know.
Yeah.
You know, create energy, all that good stuff.
Okay. So we talked about gymnasts. We talked about swimmers. Let's maybe talk about track and field a little bit. A lot of the same themes are going to be running throughout. A lot of anterior orientation. You have a population. Oh. Now you're on land, so you need to adapt in order to put force down into the ground at a very high rate.
Without question.
And then also be able to put that force into the ground quickly at a high rate in the beginning, but then toward the end of your race, you have to be able to expand and keep your center of gravity off the ground longer than everybody else. An ideal scenario. That's why the Usain Bolt's became the sort of like outlier of sport.
Sprinting.
And not a lot of tall sprinters at this last Olympics, not a lot of Usain Bolts out there. I don't know why. Maybe it's because they kind of get selected early on as they don't really make it past certain points in their career. Maybe Usain Bolt was lucky enough to not blow himself apart early on. Like a lot of these, maybe tall sprinters tried to do. I don't know. I think there's some selection to that, but yeah, what are some of the commonalities with those sprinters, and what are some of the distinct differences between like them and gymnasts and swimmers?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, so you're going to see when we talk about configurations and such, you're going to see a little bit more of like in the runners themselves, you're going to see more of like a funnel shape differential between inlets and outlets, which gives you an advantage of air time. It gets you off the ground easier, and you spend a little bit more time in the air, which if you can apply enough force into the ground and you stay in the air longer, you're faster.
Right.
And
lower pressure environment up top, higher pressure environment down low allows for the stuff to go into the area of expansion and stay there longer. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll rarely see a great jumper that's built like a refrigerator.
Yeah.
Right. But again, now look at the variations within runners themselves. So you look at the sprinters that they have to run 10 seconds. And then as you extend the distance, right, the extreme of the funnel, changes its grade just a little bit. And then eventually you get to the marathoners and they look very piston-y, like they're almost the same circumference from top to bottom. And that's an efficiency right. thing. So it's not that they're slow runners. See, this is the thing, that they're slow relative to this.
Yeah.
They're slow relative to the sprinters, but they're still running really, really fast.
Yeah. Some of those guys, they projected that like the best marathoners might still be able to run like 11 seconds in the 100.
Yeah.
Like a little above 11 seconds, which is like super fast still. Like faster than anyone, any normal person's running. Yeah.
But a second of time.
Right. One whole second.
looks like a gigantic distance. Yeah.
One Mississippi. Yeah. It's a huge huge distance.
Yeah. But again, it's like they're just following structure. And so again, at the highest levels, you'll see like a 400 meter runner will kind of look like the sprinter that can cross over from like the 100 to the 200. There's going to be commonalities. It's sort of like evolution. It's like the next level of speed kind of looks like the level below them as far as distance goes, and then slightly like the level above. So like the 400 meter runner has some of that 200 meter stuff, and they have some of that 800 meter stuff. And then you go with the next one, and it's like the 800 meter kind of looks like 400, but then they got a little bit of this miler thing. And then as you go up in mileage, it's like the funnel shape starts to disappear and they become much more cylindrical. Because again, it's a matter of efficiency. It's try to run at that pace for 2 hours and change. It's like you got to be boom 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 boom. It's like there's this evenness to the pace that has to be established. And so if you had a bias that would bias you either up or down, it's like you one won't be able to last long enough, or you're going to be pushing into the ground way too long, and you'll definitely not make it.
Okay, so. A lot of so athletes are not the best movers, and just they compensate better than everyone else in the context of whatever event they're trying to do. It's a lot of orientations happening, and the movement that they're being allowed, or they're allowing themselves, the movement that we're seeing be allowed is because of the spine twisting and turning in order to allow pieces to stay locked together, which creates a better return on connective tissue behavior, return of energy.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. But there's likely to be a secondary negative consequence of that. Absolutely. Because I rob certain areas and tissues from like water and blood and flow of stuff by just squeezing everything together for so long. And with under such high intensities as well for long durations of time. And that's, you're going to see a lot of banged up athletes. You're going to see a lot of hip knee replacements. You're going to see a lot of like not walking so well in their 50s and 60s. They do a lot of speaking engagements, but they're not doing a lot of other physical activities anymore. That's for sure.
What's the little girl that's the American gymnast? What's her name?
Simone Biles.
Yeah. She's in her late 20s, which is unusual for a gymnast.
Yeah, she's old.
She becomes a bit of the exception, not the rule. And that sort
she took time off, though. I think that might have helped her as well, right?
Yeah, but it's still from a capability standpoint.
Yeah,
it's like there's windows of opportunity. This is why you see like female swimmers tend to be very successful very early. It's not unusual to see a 16, 17-year-old swimmer participating at the world level. But again, the window that they remain successful is very small. It's like, I remember I don't know if you remember Mark Spitz.
I do. Okay. With that slicked back hair, right?
Well, he was famous
and
for
the mustache.
Like the mustache. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Greg Louganis.
There you go.
Yeah.
But he tried to make a comeback. I think it was like 40 or 41, and tried to make a comeback as a swimmer. And it's like, it's just really hard. Like, and again, arguably like 1972, I think he won 6 or 7 gold medals, you know, hard to do. Cause you're just outside that window where you have the greatest capacities to do your sport. But it's like, you know, in every sport, we've had exceptions to the rule in like basketball, where you have guys that can play, you know, into their early 40s, you know, Tom Brady played into his mid-40s in football. Now, granted, he was a quarterback, not a person that would get hit on a regular basis.
Right.
He did obviously take his hits, but not like you would like a running back. You would never see a running back playing into their 40s. They just get hit too often.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Tom Brady example is a really good, I think, is a very good example of letting an athlete with a certain structure and certain talents play to their strengths for their entire career most of their career. Yeah. Because you let him have the time to move. You don't try to like superimpose all this lifting and training on top of him to get him bigger or stronger. You let him like do his thing. Like, and that, yeah, I think it didn't cause any sort of interference. Plus he had an awesome offensive line to help him not get wrecked all the time.
Yeah.
Plus they changed the rules of the game, right? They made it so that you can't rough the quarterback nearly as much as you used to be able to.
Oh yeah. It used to be bad.
Yeah, it's rough. It was rough for those guys. But we were talking about like Dan Marino, right? Like,
oh yeah,
these guys that guys that were playing, these guys that had these long, great careers and were still getting rocked.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Getting just jacked up by a bunch of coked out, roided up defensive players.
Dan Marino, if you're out there, you're still the best quarterback that has ever played the game. Hands down.
Yeah, I mean, he's... Yeah. I'm trying to think of other. Yeah, I guess there's. Yeah, he's pretty legendary in terms of,
like what he was able to do with the rules that they had under the circumstances, and then should we throw out our question of the day?
I don't even remember what it was. There's something about classic rock.
Yeah, it's like what's your favorite Queen song?
Oh, what's your favorite? Yeah, what's your favorite song by the band Queen?
Yeah.
It's a good question. I'm not even going to answer. I'll answer.
I think I got to go with We Are the Champions.
That's a great song. I'm a singer.
So I like songs that I can sing and I can sing that song. And so that's one of the reasons why I like it so much. Yeah,
I think Fat Bottom Girls is a pretty good song for singers as well.
That's a great song.
That's a great song.
I have to think about that one for singing.
We Are the Champions is a good. Yeah, it might be better than that. I'm trying to think of like what's my favorite. I don't know. I'll answer in the comments. How about that?
There you go. Perfect.
All right.